Well, hi. So I'm here with Professor Dr. James Maffey, who's the author of a book we reviewed a long time ago that I probably should have done this back when I read it 2 or 3 years back. So it'd be a little fresher on my mind. But Aztec philosophy, which is interesting. So you have, and it's, I was wanting to bring my copy to show it off, but I'm noticing it's on the shelf right behind you with the cover visible. So I'm glad that that we can see it. And I'd love to hear some of your book. Like, one of the reasons I was so like interested by it is like I was a comparative religion guy at Swanee, and then like now I'm more of a Jungian leaning therapist. I do some more. I think the newer neurology is actually validating the older Jungian phenomenology in a way that we probably won't rewind the clock and give anybody the credit they deserve. But so I'm always into that stuff, and I love mythology. And but Aztec mythology was always kind of hard for me to intuitively get because there were so many like cultural distinctions, you know, some of that regional, some of that economic, that they just look different and that affects culture differently. And reading your book, it's like, oh, that's it. Like, this is the thing that makes the art make sense. This is the thing that makes the ritual make sense. This is the thing that makes economy make sense. So the title, like when you named it Aztec philosophy, was that kind of a practical thing in that you were trained in philosophy and wanted to publish there? Or because it more of is kind of about metaphysics almost, or a cultural kind of assumption. What was, can you tell us about your process in writing that and conceiving of the book?
I mean, the book is about metaphysics, but metaphysics is a chapter of philosophy. But the book didn't get the title Aztec Metaphysics because the publisher thought no one would read it. So that's why I have the broader title, and that's why in the introduction I make it clear that the book is addressing specifically the metaphysics, and that in a subsequent book I'll address the ethics.
Well, a lot of some people may not be familiar a ton, you know, with all of Aztec culture. So I guess, and correct me where I'm wrong here, because most of the stuff I've read about, you know, it's not, I may be mispronouncing something or I may not grasp it perfectly, but, you know, the Aztec is actually the military, you know, imperial class of the, of an empire. We use it to refer to a whole civilization, but the Mexica and the Nahua are going to be, am I saying this correctly?
Yeah, it should be Mexica.
Mexica, okay. Nahua. Yeah. So, and could you tell us a little bit about that cultural group, just the structure of the empire before you get into, you know, the philosophy part?
Well, the Aztec is a word that was given. It's a European word. I mean, it's a Nahuatl derived. Nahuatl is the language of the Aztec, or the Mexica, or more broadly, there's a whole ethnic group who are Nahuatl speakers, and they are collectively referred to as the Nahuas or the Nahuas. And a German named von Humboldt decided to name them the Aztecs because they had mythically originated in a place called Aztlan, which is mythically northwest Mexico, southwest USA. And that is, in fact, where the people who we call the Aztecs, but they're properly the Mexica, they originated from. They and a lot of other Nahuatl speakers migrated down from that area of the southwest U.S., northwest Mexico in the 14th century. The language itself, Nahuatl, is part of what linguists call the Uto-Aztecan language. It's related to Luiseno, Cahuilla, Ute, Paiute, Comanche, and Hopi. So there's a whole language group there, and within Mexico, it's related to Huichol and Cora as well, and all the way down to San Salvador, El Salvador, the Pipil, which is an Uto-Aztecan language. So Nahuatl, that language, became the lingua franca of the Mexica or the Aztec Empire. So the Mexica were one specific group who followed a guy named Tenochtitlan, and their capital city on the island was called Tenochtitlan after him. But they were not the only Nahuatl speakers. So, as I said, scholars refer to this whole sort of cultural linguistic group of people as the Nahuas, because the sources that we have are not confined specifically to Mexica. They're post-conquest, and they are derived from interviews with a variety of Nahuatl speakers from around the Great Basin and the highlands of Mexico, that lake area in where like 1 to 2 million people, Nahuatl speakers, lived. So the Aztecs weren't just, they were one of many groups who were Nahuatl speakers. They happened to be formed part of what's called the Triple Alliance with two other city states. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
And so a lot of the Aztec culture that people are familiar with is probably like the, what we would imagine of like human sacrifice, festivals, pyramids.
Right.
And a lot of that stuff, I think, seems kind of alien until you understand some cultural assumptions. Because I was always like reading, trying to make those make sense. And some of the theories I just didn't really find plausible at all. Like there was somebody, you know, in the 70s that wrote a paper, was like, well, they just didn't have a lot of meat.
Right.
They kind of had to eat people. And it was like, well, yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's ducks, there's other stuff. You know, there were some other people that were like, well, you know, the religion was so strong that the people who were getting captured in the flower wars really wanted to be sacrificed. They thought that was great. Yet they did tend to side with Cortez and say, we don't like the Aztecs. So yeah. I had a hard time kind of buying that. But I think your book makes a lot of the like assumptions that seem bizarre to us moderns or people that are coming from a more Western background make a ton of sense. That this concept of Tiot is like this energy that is constantly sort of roiling and devouring and sustaining itself. And that everything that the Aztecs are doing is a reenactment of that sort of implicit assumption about the way the universe works. I mean, you call it being on slippery earth. Always trying to, we're just a small stumble away from the sun not coming up, or water not being wet, or fire not being hot, or food not digesting. That you're sort of in conversation with roiling energy, with your entire culture, your architecture, your language. You know, I don't know as much about the language as you do, but is there a reflection there?
A reflection of what?
Like the concept of the Tiot that you talk about in the way that language is.
Language actually is a way of transmitting life energy, or Tiot. Mm-hmm. And the principal way actually for the Mexica and other Mesoamerican peoples as well, the principal way of what we would call worshiping or honoring or revering the deities, who are actually not sort of deities in the Western sense, is through song and poetry, through the spoken word. So words are powerful. Unlike we think sticks and stones will break your bones, but words will never hurt you. For them, words actually are causally potent.
Yeah.
So the principal way of worshiping the deities is actually through song, spoken word, what we would call prayer. And this is made very clear in a Quiche Maya text called the Popol Vuh, in which the gods there create human beings who can speak properly, because it's only through proper speech that humans can properly nourish and refuel and sustain the so-called gods.
Mm-hmm.
So on this view, I mean, those things we call gods are in fact dependent upon human beings. So there's a symbiotic relationship between humans and so-called deities. It's actually, the metaphysics is a form of pantheism, where it's just one thing, Tiot. It's powerful, it's sacred, it's all-encompassing. Everything is ultimately one with it. And what we call deities are simply what some anthropologists call an other-than-human persons, a little less derogatory than non-humans. But so there are all these other than human persons in the world: tables, chairs, cats, dogs, trees, lakes, mountains. And some of those are also people like Quetzalcoatl or Tlaloc, or who are typically described as deities, but they're just simply more powerful than human persons. So they create us, but they create us in order to nourish them, because they're exhausted after creating the world. So we're created and we're born with indebted to them, because we owe our life and our existence to them. So we then gift back to them various things: spoken word, poetry, song, music, burning copal incense, human hearts and flesh, to be sure, as well as tortillas, amaranth, dough figures, a variety of foodstuffs. And they then re-nourish us through the revitalization of nature, maize, and through agriculture. So there's a mutual, there's a symbiotic relationship between humans and the so-called deities. We depend upon them and they depend upon us. Mm-hmm. So there's a very dramatic contrast with the notion of a god. I think even in like Greek, Roman, and Abrahamic religions, mm-hmm. there the gods are not dependent upon human beings. Mm-hmm. This whole idea is modeled upon the symbiotic relationship between cultivated maize and human beings. Mm. Maize cannot reproduce without human intervention. If you look at a dried up maize husk, I mean, the corn kernels, the seeds in there are trapped inside that husk and they mm-hmm. cannot get out. For maize to reproduce, it requires human intervention. Mm. For us to reproduce, we need maize intervention, so to speak. We need to consume maize. Mm. So maize and human beings are symbiotic. They're mutually interdependent. And that's the Mexica's model for the relationship between humans and the gods, and actually humans and the whole cosmos. The cosmos cannot reproduce without human beings nourishing it, and we cannot reproduce without the cosmos nourishing us. So when it comes to any sort of notion of, we think of there a sacred, profane, god versus human distinction, it falls apart, because ultimately we eat the gods in the form of maize and water, and they eat us in the form of our blood or our flesh. So we eat godly stuff, they eat humanly stuff, and you are what you eat. That makes us very, very, actually, at the end of the day, identical, ontologically speaking, in terms of what we're made out of.
We're interlinked, that all of the different aspects of creation are always connected to the next one. You know,
not just interlinked, but made up of the same stuff. Mm-hmm. There's no nature super nature distinction. Mm-hmm. It cuts between that. That's one of these dualisms we get out of Western philosophy.
Yeah, it almost feels like quantum physics, part of it, reading what you're saying. Well, yes.
I mean, I don't know enough to intelligently address that, but a lot of people would say so. Yeah. There's some really good work done by Andinist named Marisol de la Cadena. She wrote a book called Earth Beings, and she discusses very similar notion in indigenous Andean philosophy, and she does appeal to contemporary quantum mechanics.
If you follow kind of math or neurology too far to one direction, you sort of end up in metaphor and away from numbers in a way that makes the empiricists sort of frustrated, I think.
Yeah, true enough.
Well, I mean, there's like a present tenseness to the kind of religious process you're describing that is not really in other cultures. I mean, if you look at Greek or Norse or something, I mean, there's like a history where the gods did a bunch of stuff and then they quit, and now they've sort of gone to another place, and we still have to sometimes beg them to deign to notice us or show that we remember them to not get punished. But it isn't part of every part of life. You know, it isn't part of food. It isn't part of art. It isn't part of culture in this way that you describe it being in the book.
Right.
And to me, like, Aztec architecture was almost kind of like overwhelming to look at. Like, when you look at the pictures, it's like pictures within pictures within pictures. Like, it looks like a magic eye. There's a serpent wrapped around the whole building, but the serpent's so big that the pieces of the serpent are making this tableau. But then in that tableau, there's other little things. And so I always thought, you know, when I was younger, well, that's just how they did architecture. But you go back to the Olmecs and the Toltecs, the empires before that, and the architecture looks Greek almost, like the figure of the wrestler they excavated. I mean, it's very kind of traditional. So do you think that architecture is a reflection of the kind of metaphysics you're describing, that all of this stuff is interlinked and put together? I mean, things like the moon disk that they excavated in Tenochtitlan, I mean, that looks like a Picasso painting. It looks like Guernica or something, you know, like, in a way that, you know, it took us hundreds of years to rediscover that kind of impressionistic felt sense of art.
Yeah. I mean, I think my sense is that the sort of metaphysics that I'm attributing to the Aztecs is actually deeply entrenched within and widely spread within Mesoamerica. So it would be there even in the Olmecs, the Toltecs, Mixtecs, Zapotecs, and Maya as well.
I know there's not a lot of historical record left. There's, you know, the Aztecs are trying to link their leaders to the leaders of the past empire for legitimacy and things.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, from your impression, you know, you can't say anything super concrete a lot of the time. But from your impression, why is the Aztec art architecture so different than Olmec's Toltecs if that metaphysical assumption was not changed?
I guess, I mean, there isn't that much Toltec art around, and it doesn't strike me as all that dissimilar, actually. Actually, and a lot of the Aztec art is modeled directly after the Toltec art, because they did visit Tula, the archaeological remains of Tolan, or where the Toltecs were, and there's lots of art within the so-called sacred precinct, the ceremonial center of Tenochtitlan, that modeled closely after it. So I don't think there's a big difference. Olmecs, I mean, yeah, I don't know why they are different. Sure. Their explanation would be that what we're calling art is in fact not art. It's in fact alive. The whole notion of attributing to other cultures a Western notion of art is basically misguided. those things are all living persons. There's a very famous, well, not so very famous film that when I visited the Humboldt Forum in Germany, in Berlin last summer, there's a quote from a film, I believe it translates, it's a French film made in the 50s. The French title translates as something like "Even Statues Die." And there was a quote from it right next to the Benin bronzes that the Humboldt Forum owns. And it says, when men die, right, it's quote, when men die, they become history. When statues die, they become art. So there's this idea that all these things are alive and that they're living, and that when they get conquered and colonized, we come in and go, oh, no, that's art, because we're unwilling to see that that dismembered figure at the bottom there is actually probably still alive and was alive in some sense for the Aztecs. But paintings, sculptures, these things are all alive. And this tends to be pretty much a what we call New World-wide phenomenon, that Native peoples see even geometric figures as sort of, in some sense, vivifying and alive. Some patterns are compatible with, you eat out of a bowl with certain patterns, you don't eat out of a bowl with other patterns. The pattern has a causal effect upon things. And so, in a sense, it's energized and vivifying as well. So why the Aztecs would claim that they're painting their gods the way they do, they're building their buildings the way they do, because they've been told to do so by gods. It's not simply a matter of artistic convention or style, individual whimsy. The gods don't let you depict them any way willy-nilly. There's a specific way in which they want you to do that. Mm-hmm. So the sculptor, the artist, the painter has these communications, conversations with the gods, and the gods tell them how they wish to be presented, not represented, but presented, because the god's there in all its fullness.
Mm.
The analogy that will come most to mind for us is, think about the Eucharist and communion for Catholics, right? You eat the wafer, that is Jesus's flesh. You drink the wine, that is Jesus's blood. Protestants take over and it becomes symbolic of Jesus's flesh, symbolic of Jesus's blood. But for the Catholics, especially pre-Reformation Catholics, I mean, it's there, and Jesus is in there, and Jesus' flesh and Jesus, his essence is in there. Analogously, for the Mexica, a statue of, let's say, Tlaloc or Quetzalcoatl, Quetzalcoatl is right there. That is Quetzalcoatl. It's not a representation, picture of, depiction of, symbol of Quetzalcoatl. It is Quetzalcoatl. And you can talk with him one-on-one. So they are presentations, not representations. This whole notion of everything being a symbol or a picture of, a symbol of, a representative of, is all comes out of the Protestant Reformation and semiotics, which comes out of that as well. So for them, this stuff is not, strictly speaking, art, just other persons made out of stone or ink and paper or jade.
Well, a lot that jumps out there that's fascinating. I mean, firstly, that quote that you share seems like you found something that was incredibly in keeping with the philosophy behind your book in that museum. That's a really beautiful statement. And two, it sounds like, you know, the communion is a lot more of a ritual. It is a communing with, but it doesn't change, and it's not up to the participant what it looks like. What you're describing about being told by the gods what kind of art they want to make sounds like a pretty poetic description of intuition, you know?
Well, they wouldn't call it intuition, because they would call it oracular communication.
Yeah. Well, I think some Jungians would maybe call intuition that too.
Who would?
Some Jungian analysts.
Jungians, yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, if your worldview assumes the worldview of modern natural science, then yeah, all of this talk has to be recast in terms of intuitions or stuff in the head or symbols. I mean, you've got to, right. I mean, I don't know about, you know, the deromanticization of nature that happens, right? Weber talks about it and others, right? With modern science, qualities, colors, tastes, sounds, the magical, all of that, which is in even within European metaphysics, pre Galileo, pre natural science, all of that just gets sucked out of nature and put into our heads. It's all up here now. Yeah. It's not out there, because the only thing out there is physics, right? A world, matter in motion with quantitative properties alone.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm not gonna go with you. Travel with you to Jungian land or Freudian land or semiotics land, because I'm not so much interested in explaining in some sort of scientific or Western sense why they think what they do. I'm trying to understand, in fact, what they do think.
Sure.
And then if you want to explain it this other way, that's fine. But I devote myself to trying to get in their heads and understanding what's going on.
Yeah, no, and I'm not at all trying to pull you out of that experience. I just know a lot of, especially older Jungians that are kind of part of the transpersonal psychology movement, view the self not really as an individual, but as a part of systems interacting with the world and also interacting with the body. It's more of the kind of, most of kind of academic psychology, I think, unfortunately, views the body as this go-kart that carries the brain around, and the brain does all the thinking, and it we might as well just pluck it out and be it put in a jar, because that's all we are. There are alternative psychologies to that that are popping up as we try and do things.
Fair enough.
But so Teot, you say in the book, has kind of three main manifestations that sometimes overlap and interact. Could you go through those manifestations of the energy that, because I think those are important, ways to help understand what your point is there.
Sure. So Teot is this sort of constant energy in motion, always changing, always becoming, always moving, always processing. So that foundation gives you a pantheism. It also gives you what Western philosophers call a process metaphysics. The basic stuff of the universe are processes, not things, right? And this contrasts with the dominant mode in Western philosophy, starting with Plato at least, that the building blocks of the world are things of one kind or another that are permanent. You know, they can be atoms. For Plato, they could be forms. We could think they're substances, entities, things. But the world, the furniture of the universe consists of things. Process metaphysics argues that the furniture, if that's appropriate, of the universe are processes, parades, seasons, rainfalls, waterfalls, floodings, things going on. So the world is always moving, always changing, always transforming into something else. So the three patterns that Teot adopts in this, and motion here also includes change, right? We think of motion as just going from point A to point B. But if you go back to Aristotle, changing through, let's say, moving through the life cycle from infancy to, you know, to young adulthood to old age. That's a kind of movement. So they agree on that. So there's not only physical movement from point A to point B, but there's also motion in the sense of going through a life change, them, you know, aging, dying, life renewal. Mm-hmm. So there's three patterns. One is called Olin, and it is the kind of motion which it's exhibited by a bouncing ball. It's sort of parabolic like that, as I recall. Yeah, bouncing ball, beating heart. It's also the motion through the four stages of our life cycle. So there's a kind of specific motion, and they depict it in a particular kind of way.
So it's like an oscillation almost.
Yeah.
Keeping this bouncing between two.
And the sun going up and down and up and down, up and over, up and over, up and over the surface of the earth. That is the pattern or how Teot moves in that particular way.
Would any kind of philosophical or natural paradox be seen as that? I know you don't mention that in the book, but it was a question.
Paradoxes?
Yeah, the idea that you have two things that are paradoxical but both true or something. Is that ever brought up in any kind of cultural or literary?
I don't think so. Not least concerning Olin.
Okay, I was just curious.
Yeah. Then there's another kind of motion change, pattern of motion change, right? It's different, not a different kind of energy, but a different pattern of this Teot's constant moving and becoming, which is spiraling. What they call that Malanali. And that's the pattern of energy it takes for transmitting energy between levels of the cosmos, the levels of the universe. So if I want to, you know, get energy going up if I want to transmit life energy to the gods, up, since they reside above me, I spin it, I order it, I do that, and that is how energy is transmitted from below the earth to the surface of the earth, above the earth.
You and said that was how they viewed digestion, was a whirling of food into the body.
Because fire is conceived as that, and they see fire as a burning.
I was wondering if some of the sacrifice rituals couldn't almost be like a reverse digestion, that you're taking a living thing and spiraling it back up into this cosmic energy to feed the gods.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know about reverse digestion, but
I'm thinking of, you take the food and you put it into the person to make the person, sort of taking the food out of the person to put it back into the gods.
Well, reverse, just to say that it's cyclical, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're always meant to be recycling the life energies which the gods have given us, recycling them back to them. So, yeah, you're right. One of the more sort of dramatic examples is there's so-called gladiator stone. You can look it up, but it's once again not appropriately called that. But it's a circular, like a pedestal on which a captured warrior would engage in combat. Ritual combat, but they had actual weapons with Mexica warriors. And what they would do is spin them around. They'd rotate around, round, and around this circular pedestal. And in the process, also try to kill them at first, but just to what they would call stripe them, to nick them so that he would bleed and spread his blood around this thing. And this thing, actually, the word for it is the word for a spindle whorl. And a spindle whorl, as you know, is the heavy weight you put in the bottom of a spindle rod when you're spinning raw cotton into spun cotton, and it's a way of ordering. So what they did was they spun him around like this, and that would, in fact, transmit the energy in his blood up to the cosmos. So, yeah, that's one of the ways they recycled it.
When someone's saying, oh, this is so alien and bizarre and brutal or something, but when you're understanding these assumptions as that the universe, is always being sustained by itself and going through these things, and it's our job to sustain it, I mean, you're just taking the heart back out of the body, giving it back to the gods. Unfortunately, this guy lost the flower war now, and then later that will be me. And there was a sense of being comfortable, even if the individual maybe didn't like it, the society was comfortable and natural with it as just this inevitable thing that's kind of going to happen anyway. You know, I'm thinking of that, like, what is it in the Bhagavad Gita, where the line where the guy's like, I don't really want to fight all these people. Like, it just seems like a mean thing to kill all of them. And, you know, Shiva says, even without your sword, behold, I have become time. Even without your sword, all of these men will crumble and turn into dust. What you do is nothing.
Huh.
You know?
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah. I mean, there's not an eventuality in the Aztec case, at least to the extent I understand the eventuality in the example you just gave. This stuff isn't going to happen eventually unless, I mean, because human beings actually need to intervene.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah.
Beyond the continuing existence of the cosmos, I mean, all of nature, as we would call it, requires human participation and intervention.
And
we're, as human beings, created specifically for that job.
Sure.
That's our purpose.
I'm not trying to compare it to Hinduism in that way, but I do want to try and reach the person who still is not feels disconnected from this set of assumptions as part of
you
know, something that they can understand.
For sure. I mean, and I think it would be mistaken to think that everybody was on board, especially some of the victims or heart donors, unwilling heart donors. The warriors, you're right. I mean, that was part of a, you know, warrior cult, military cult, that was part of the honor. You either die in the battlefield or die on the sacrificial stone.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a, you know, if they died that way, they had a very honorable post-mortem existence of accompanying the sun
mm-hmm.
for several years every morning, and then eventually becoming monarch butterflies.
Mm-hmm.
But for the rest of there were, you know, people who had not chattel slavery, but people who had been bought maybe because, you know, they owed a lot of money, and those people could be sold to someone else for a sacrifice. And I'm sure they weren't keen on it.
And I know Campbell used to say that all mythology has to do with, you know, dealing with guilt or shame. I don't know that I'd go that far, but a lot of it is us kind of trying to have a story about things that we have to do anyway. And
huh.
I mean, it was an empire, and when the empires work by expanding, and then when they hit a either geographic or cultural or economic boundary where they can't expand anymore, either the empire falls or the front uh-huh. comes home.
Uh-huh.
And when that front is coming home, you have to have some sort of sustaining game where the empire can imperialize itself. And these flower wars were basically a way to continue mm-hmm. to have, we're going to go out, we're going to kill the dark, bad, scary other, we're going to bring it back in, except, well, they're just kind of symbolic of that. Actually, these are football games. You know, we're going to, because the point of the flower wars was not to go out and kill a bunch of people.
No.
It was to capture them. That's what you got rewarded right. for. And then
the other side felt the same way, right? It wasn't mm-hmm. a one-way street. Their mm-hmm. flower wars with the people from Tlaxcala, right? They went out in order to seize Aztec warriors for the very same purpose. So it was a mutually agreed upon thing. It wasn't just the Aztecs terrorizing the Tlaxcaltecans.
Are you familiar with the role that football plays in the American South, you know, the SEC? Have you at least heard of this religious experience that we do?
No, I haven't.
If you ever, I'm not a huge football fan other than I like cultural anthropology, but if you ever get a chance to come to Alabama and see what a game is like in Tuscaloosa, I wonder if you don't think about the Flower Wars and the role
wow.
that they play. I mean,
it's a bloodletting sport, is it?
I don't mean just in the violence, but I mean the cultural role where it's like you, when I told my wife when she moved from Indiana, like when you go to your school, the elementary school kids are going to say, who do you go for? And that means which football team do you like? And they're going to form an opinion of you based on what you say and have an animosity to that. You're going to be like, no, it's okay, because she doesn't like conflict. And then I took her to Tuscaloosa to see a game when she was looking at the quad. And they've rented out for an insane amount of money just a teeny tiny little square on the grass. And people who don't have a ticket to the game, this isn't the stadium, this is the quad of the college, have brought their entire living room, a generator, their lamp, their couch, their big screen, their barbecue grill. And they're just sitting in a recreation of their living room closer to Mecca. Wow. Where you can hear the roar of the stadium with a slight delay on your TV and coming directly from the stadium behind you that you don't have a ticket to get into.
Wow.
So, I don't know. it makes it, a lot of your book reminded me of that. Wow. A lot of Aztec culture.
I should get the third pattern since you asked. The third one is called
Sorry to go down that rabbit hole.
Yeah. And it's back and forth motion.
Mm-hmm.
It's the motion between, I mean, actually in battle, right? Thrust, parry, thrust, parry, thrust, parry. It's the motion involved in weaving. It's the motion back, forth involved in sexual intercourse. It's a motion that the Mexica see as creating this in-between space, not in the liminal negative way, but it's in a positive way, that in this in-between space, something new is created. A third thing, a tertium quid, is created between sexual intercourse. That third thing is created as a child, and also a union between these two people, which otherwise doesn't exist. When it comes to weaving together warp and weft creates this new thing, a woven shirt, right? And that is one of the most powerful ones because that's involved in balancing. So it's that back, forth, which actually is then also typified in the constant gifting, regifting between humans and gods. They gift us life. We gift them life. When you accept a gift, you're obliged to regift. So there's this constant sort of back, forth, mutuality of gifting. I gift you, you gift me. I gift you, you gift me. I invite you to dinner. If you're good manners, you invite me back over to dinner. We go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And that creates this unity of interrelatedness between humans and gods. But it also is the model for all human interactions, this mutual gifting. Teachers gift life energy to their students. They're therefore indebted, and they are obliged to re-gift something back to their teachers.
Mm.
Parents gift their children lives. Children are obliged to re-gift by taking them care of them in their old age. So this notion of this mutual exchange, re-gifting and re-gifting of life energy is very, very central to interhuman relationships and, you know, human divine relationships as well. And that's the third kind of motion. And so this one actually is very defining of the cosmos itself, because the Aztecs see the cosmos basically as a woven fabric.
Mm.
And it's woven through all these various kinds of actions of human beings and interactions. So despite the Aztecs' reputation as being bloodthirsty warrior cult, I mean, one of the basic metaphors, but I don't think it is a metaphor, that's our talk, is that the cosmos is this weaving in progress, this back, forth between polarities, male, female, life, death, hot, cold, day, night, winter, summer, winter, summer. You want to keep that back and forth going in this balanced way, and that maintains the cosmos in a balanced state.
It almost sounds like a description of philosophy itself, too. That one person has this discourse with this other person, another thing is created. The thesis,
ideally, yeah.
Synthesis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's also very similar to Taoism. You probably heard you already. These dualities, these polarities are like yin yang. They're mutually arising, mutually interdependent. Death arises from life. Life arises from death. You can't be alive without killing something, and you can't be dead unless you are alive. So there's this notion that these dualities or polarities go back and forth and back and forth, and that they form a unified duality or a dual unity. They don't disappear, but they form this tertium quid, this third thing. And so that's very, very fundamental to it, maintaining this circulation, this back, this cyclical day, night, winter, summer, male, female, life, death, just going on and on. And that's, I mean, that's what the cosmos is, this cyclical alternation between these mutually arising, mutually interdependent polarities or dualities. And the idea that you could have something like life without death, eternal life, Christian style, is just quite literally nonsensical. It's conceptually absurd. It's like being a brother, an only child and a brother, right? You can't be a brother unless you have a brother, right? And having God be just a man is just as incoherent as a single child brother, because reproduction requires male-female interaction, right? So how could you possibly just have a male create the universe by himself? It literally makes no sense.
They don't see the disconnection of opposites or time in the way that a lot of other do you think some of that was influenced by there being like kind of like less written language accessible, that most interaction is verbal, that the civilization is smaller? Do you see any kind of cultural reality reinforcing that belief, or just kind of a product of the culture that didn't come from anything material?
I mean, if you're looking for the outside explanation, I mean, I think it goes back to maize agriculture. Mm-hmm. Humans can't reproduce without maize. Maize can't reproduce without humans. Mm. Right? That is like the keystone to understanding how they can see the universe, and that's shared throughout Mesoamerica, that the fundamentalness of the human-maize relationship. The Mayas, many argue, do have a written language and embrace the same idea. Yeah. So I don't think it's the dominance of orality which explains it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and maize is so important to just why the civilization was able to be there. If you go further north in America, you're spending all your time kind of hunting and gathering. You don't have the luxury of building a pyramid just with time, but you also may have to move from the place where you built it.
Maize agriculture in North America.
They did.
You get Cahokia. You got lots of large ceremonial centers, Chaco Canyon, going on, Canyon de Chelly, Cahokia.
I live close to Moundville.
They may have, it strikes me that Cahokia had to be largely maize dependent. Anytime you have a settled existence, you're a farmer.
You're farming.
And maize is there. Maize traveled down to South America and up to North America. It is, I guess, just talk with a guy who told me that he thinks that maize went down to the Andes and then a different species went back up north. So it's a really complicated history. But yeah, I think humans in the Americas, ended up transforming something called tzitzintle, which is basically a wild grass seed, into what we think of as maize about 6,000 years ago.
The corn started off about that big. It was a little, kind of fat wheat berries.
At best.
Well, and it's across all of North and South America, but the ability to farm it and the quantity to have the surplus really was kind of a luxury of that region. And some of that was agricultural, the farmland and the weather patterns and all that, but other parts of it, and maybe access to certain varieties of it, where they didn't have that ability. But there's also the Aztecs' ability to like soaking maize in lye to create hominy and preserving it, and just things that were a technological product that had not really traveled that far.
I think it was throughout the Americas. Everybody.
Hominy was everywhere? Yeah. It was associated with southern.
I think it was succotash, if I'm not mistaken, is hominy.
Huh. I don't know that one specifically. I have to look that up.
It's Europeans, when they brought it back to Europe, didn't know they needed to soak it in lime, and ended up, I forget the name of the disease that you get from niacin deficiency from not soaking. Scurvy?
Is it scurvy?
No, that's vitamin C deficiency.
Vitamin C. Yeah, I don't know.
And, and it took them a while to figure it out. I don't know how they discovered that, but the making of what's called nishtamal I think it's all over.
Okay. Huh. I always associated the Mesoamerican region with just increased output agriculture.
Well, do have increased output. I mean, that's true. And especially the Aztecs as you said, anytime you have settled existence and then have can afford the surplus labor to be building monumental architecture, you've got production which exceeds a certain level. So you're absolutely right. That's also true of the Andes.
Yeah.
And mound culture, Cahokia,
I don't know if it's apocryphal, because I, you know, I'm not an academic, and so I don't have to cite sources and things. No one's going to give me an F, but if I get it wrong. But I had like a history teacher a long time ago tell me about some story where the Spanish were like, show us the gods. Where are the gods? And they like take them to some statue or carving, and the Spanish smashed it. And the Aztecs are just kind of blasé, and they're like, look at the gods. And they're like, no, the gods are not here. And then they think they're lied to or something. And they're like, where are they? What are the gods? And the Aztecs just think they're stupid. They're like, this is what they look like. Here you go. Here's the picture of the process. And the Spanish keep trying to deface these things. And then they're not, they don't understand, because they're trying to, they think it's like stepping on the cross or breaking an idol. And the Aztecs are just kind of like, this is a blueprint of the universe, man. Like, and you're tearing up a piece of paper. I don't understand what you want me to do.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I don't know that story.
But it may not be true. It may be an allegorical. I mean,
they wouldn't be very happy about you coming in and smashing the statue if the statue, in fact, were a presentation rather than just a picture.
Mm-hmm.
But that destroying the statue would by no means destroying the god. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, take Tlaloc, right? He was associated with rain, you know, water,
mm-hmm.
Ice, hailstorms, thunder, lightning. I mean, all of Tlaloc is in all of those exemplifications all everywhere, all at once, in different times and places. So mm-hmm. all of Tlaloc's in a rainstorm in Alabama, while also all of Tlaloc is in a rainstorm in North Dakota.
So if you could rewind time and go live in the Aztec Empire, you think you'd do that?
Just as for an exploratory thing for a couple of weeks, yeah, I'd like to do that, especially if I were an elite priest, maybe, or an elite person. I think the life of commoners was hard. They worked hard. Maize agriculture is a demanding life. Personally, I wouldn't have wanted to be a warrior. It's just not my thing. I could see doing it. I can say that about just about everywhere, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Would you?
I don't know. I don't know. There's something about the veil to me that seems scary there. Like the veil of time of uncertainty, that I can talk about this and intuitively interact with it. But if you really go back, if you really know and you see something, I don't know. Mm. I feel like there's something about that scares me.
Huh. Yeah, I think it'd be neat. I'm intriguing. I mean, I guess we're assuming that I retain all my current sensibilities and stuff, so that when I saw part sacrifice, I would be appalled. That would be hard to watch, for sure.
You don't want to meet your heroes, or in this case, your academic area.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I think like a conspiracy theory is fascinating, though I don't really go in for it. And a lot of pseudo archaeology is always like caught up in conspiracy theory a ton of the time, that, some combination of aliens and 5G and pyramids and stuff. But yeah. I am curious, like, I know that there's the Toltec story that they have, basically the Toltec Empire falls apart when one of the emperors is drinking too much and they put him on a boat and send him to North America. I mean, do you think that him and that retinue got up there? Do you think that there's anything that, you know, I've heard people before, because a lot of it on its face, it just fails conceptually. But the people that say, like, well, the reason why in the four corners you end up with things that you don't associate with a lot of North American culture just all end up there, like cannibalism and architecture and different things, is because this Toltec emperor went up there and introduced this information. I don't really believe that that's plausible, but it's one of the only ones that on the face of it, I can't say, well, that's wrong for this fundamental reason.
I've never heard. I mean, I know of the story of a guy named Quetzalcoatl, who was the ruler of Tolan, the Toltec emperor, and that he allegedly had too much pulque to drink, and I guess attempted to seduce his sister, but then he left voluntarily in shame, to the east, and then that gets turned into this idea that Cortez is, of course, his returning. How much of that is true, it's not clear, because our sources claiming that are all post-conquest sources, and a lot of them are either written by Spaniards or written by mestizos, you know, Spanish Indian people, or by the surviving, you know, the children, the grandchildren of the elite of various other city states in the area, who are out to make the Aztecs look bad, horrific, stupid.
And it's a Spanish claim to overthrow the empire if he's an emperor coming back too. Beneficial story to Cortez that he's returing as
it's true, but I mean, it looks post facto, post conquest, sort of is a post facto sort of justification rather than one that was there before. Most of the, you know, there are all these omens that Moctezuma II supposedly saw, you know, birds with this, blah, blah, blah. But scholars have examined those, and those are straight out of medieval Europe.
Yeah.
And then so somebody wrote up these things and said, oh, yeah, and the Aztecs thought that too. So you have to be very, very careful with the sources, because, like I say, a lot of the sources are written, and that's important because not everybody could write, even after the invasion. Only the elite, the sons, and maybe the daughters, but probably just the sons of the elite of various city states were brought in by the Franciscans and taught how to read and write, taught Spanish and Latin. And they tended to write stories which were self-serving, because now, I mean, in a lot of ways, the social, political, economic structure of New Spain remained the same when it was Tenochtitlan, when it was the Aztec Empire. We just had a new boss in town. The Spanish emperor was now the top dog rather than the Tlatoani, the ruler of the Aztec Empire. But so all the nobility are trying to suck up, maintain, you know, they live a rather lavish lifestyle. They live off the labor of the commoners, who are the maize farmers, and they want to retain all of that. So they're trying to suck up to the king and the Spaniards. You know, there's this jockeying for position and power taking place, and they don't want to be reduced to commoners. So they're writing things that make their ancestors look smart and not barbarous. It was the Aztecs who did all that horrible stuff. The sources are very dicey, so you have to be.
That makes sense. I never thought about the post-invasion politics of trying to play Spanish politics with your own history as a Mesoamerican. The hinge point in history where Cortez basically breaks the rules and invades without permission. I mean, it's kind of amazing that he even was able to do that with so few people. And that almost didn't happen for a lot of reasons. I mean, they came after him for trying to.
The Spanish came after
him. The Spanish came after him for trying to break the rules, you know. But if he doesn't do that, what do you think happens? I mean, it's likely that at some point somebody goes in, that empire does fall. I mean, how long do you think they get? And what do you think that changes if Cortez is just deleted from the record? And you have ships knocking around across the Caribbean discovering stuff.
It appears as if it weren't him, it would have been somebody else. The people, the tributaries of the Aztecs, right, all these smaller city-states around, you know, the greater Mexico, were not happy. No colonized people are happy having to pay tribute to an imperial power. There were the flower wars, but not everybody engaged in those. But they weren't happy. So sooner or later, someone would have done the same divide and conquer sort of strategy. I mean, and you got to remember that they all saw themselves what scholars call the micropatriotism in Mexico, that people identify with a city as opposed to the nation. And
Austria is kind of like that. If you ever go to Austria is kind of like that. If you ever go to Austria, they want you to be into their team and their beer and their region. But they don't really like the bigger Austria. They just like Steiermark or something.
Patriotism and NFL. Yeah. So So they didn't all see themselves as like, we're indigenous people. We have to unite to expel the foreigner. They saw themselves as, I'm from Tlaxcala, I'm from Cholula, I'm from here, there, right? And they was just like, let's get rid of the Aztecs. This guy promises to do it. But then, unfortunately, you know, the ideal state, which I think they thought was going to result, didn't happen because they just got sucked within the Spanish Empire and probably poorly treated as they were before, probably even worse, given the death toll after the conquest.
Yeah, it was horrific.
Yeah, and there's also right breaking up of communities, forcing them into encomiendas, sort of forced plantation systems, what's called reducciones.
I don't know the name of the movement. The only reason I know about it is because there was the guy who catered my like grad party at Swanee had this collection of artwork, but he was telling me that it was like the Spanish had taught, first generation people after the conquest to paint European style, and they could understand the proportion and the perspective and the math of it, but they couldn't ever get them to get European color. So it would be these pictures of like basically noble women and babies and things, but the colors, it's hard to describe because you can't say, oh, they're breaking one rule, but it was like the whole notion of how you colored it didn't look like that period that your brain wanted to say, oh, that's what this is. Huh. It had a kind of blending of earth tones that just was kind of atypical. Oh. I forget the name of it. That's the only place I've ever encountered it was he was showing me some of his collection. But
boy, I don't know.
I can't see
anything like that.
There's all these parts of our culture we just can't even see, see them like in that way. But
yeah,
is there anywhere we don't get? Is there anything you feel like is an important thing, something you want to jump back to, or a piece that I don't?
I think we've covered things. I guess the sort of obsessive focusing upon human sacrifice is not very helpful. I mean, it's there.
Mm-hmm.
I think we attribute more centrality to it than they did.
Yeah.
I mean, these ceremonies lasted an entire month.
Mm-hmm.
They were, very extremely religious people. When the Franciscans arrived, they were like, wow, these people are more religious than Europeans are. They mm-hmm. just happen to have been tricked by the devil, so we got to switch mm-hmm. out the devil with Jesus. But, so there were lots of things going on, and the heart sacrifice was one part of it, undeniably so. The notion of sacrifice itself doesn't quite apply, because mm-hmm. it literally means to make sacred, sacrificare, and for them, everything already is sacred. So that whole notion of doesn't apply. I mean, you can just see that as, in lots of cases, unwilling heart donors, gifting their life energies to the cosmos. But it's not just this slavish thing like, oh, we got to appease the gods or they're going to kill us and punish us. That's all Abrahamic.
The perception that Westerners have that if they didn't kill the person, the sun wouldn't come up. I think the fear of the sun not coming up, with your book does a great job of saying that this is a reenactment of a reenactment of a reenactment of the processes of the universe, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's true that the sun won't, but it isn't because the sun's pissed off. And it's like, mm-hmm. F you guys, I'm not going to rise today. It's like the sun just starved to death.
Mm-hmm.
The sun doesn't have the energy to be reborn in every morning unless we feed it. So it's really a very sort of basic sort of agricultural or horticultural model of humans and nature interacting, and we have to gift back to it in order for it to gift us. Contemporary Nahuatl speakers in Mexico would argue that Western culture isn't doing a very good job of that.
Mm-hmm.
That climate change, they're very much aware of it as dirt farmers, is the result of a gross imbalance, a failure to reciprocate, that give and give back, give and take, give and back, I give to you, you give to me. So that's really where all of that gory, horrid stuff is coming from is this idea that we have to give back to keep the thing going.
Well, there's probably a political element too, that we tend to punch down on ancient empires' bloodiness or fixate on their bloody aspects to overlook where modern empires are extremely bloody.
Oh my God. Not worse. Yeah. We don't need to state the obvious.
Mm-hmm.
The elephant in the room. No, God, good Lord. No. From the get go, the Spaniards were out to present New World people as cannibals, sodomites, what else? Those were enough to condemn them to death, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're always making other people out to be bloody, and we're sacred and holy, and we respect and revere life, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Well, this has been a wonderful conversation with you. I really appreciate your time. Sure. And I wish that I had a podcast, 3-4 years ago when I first picked up your book. You wanted to say anything about the next one, or you got anything in the works that you want us to link to? I'll definitely link to where the book can be purchased. You have a website or any other kind of web presence where you'd like me to direct people?
Unfortunately, I'm not digital savvy enough to have a website.
Okay.
I can send you some articles.
Okay.
A link to some articles on ethics. So right now I'm working on, you're probably familiar with, the skull rack.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Well, I'm arguing that in fact it's a maize field.
Hmm.
And that it's not just, the standard interpretation is going to be that it's like this gory trophy display. It's there to like intimidate everybody. Oh, we Aztecs are bad mofos. Look at all these heads we've accumulated. And it's not that at all. I mean, it may have that effect on some people, but it's only because the thing itself is inherently powerful. And it's powerful because those skulls are conceived as maize kernels. And so the whole thing is basically a cosmic milpa, and that the end stage of all the processes going on in the ceremonial precinct, the center of Tenochtitlan, and those are seeds about to be reseeded to regenerate nature. Working on a book which argues that I got too many things going on. Images in the codices, these books like this, that these are in fact alive. They're not just painted representations or depictions or symbols or pictures. They are living beings. And that person who knows what they're doing interacts with these. This is an oracular device. You take the requisite psychotropic substance, peyote, I never pronounce its word, Jimson weed. And you can talk with these people. So they're not, this is another example of when statues die, they become art. This, when these die, they become images for art historians.
Well, and that's what a lot of modern scholarship feels like cave paintings would have been used for prehistorically, that the fire animates the animal you paint, or the shaman doing the ritual. And sometimes maybe you find the right thing to be a little under the influence of a psychedelic.
Yeah. Yep. You go and you talk to them.
So would that be on vellum or on the wall? You're saying that you would open the book and
take
in the Jimson weed and you would see
you go to one page at a time. Yeah. On vellum. It's on, sometimes it's on paper, sometimes it's on deer skin. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the picture is alive. It just isn't going to talk to you until you take the right substance.
Yeah. And you got to prepare yourself. Not anybody can walk in and start talking. You have to be trained. You have to know. You have to go through various sorts of what we would call rituals, like abstinence, sexual abstinence, fasting, perhaps self-bloodletting, various ways in which they would describe as deserving or meriting conversation. You have to make yourself worthy of talking with the gods on that page. And then you take the relevant entheogen, and you can have, and it's an oracular conversation. You talk to them. You typically, right, these were used for, you're going to want to go to war, go on a military expedition, a mercantile expedition, want to get married. you go to what we call a diviner and say, look at it, when's a good time to do that? Was today a good time to do that? And so you talk to that person, and he then does all of those things and talks to these persons. Mm. And they say, nah, it's not a very good day. Or if you want us to cooperate, you're going to have to gift us certain sorts of things. So it's a matter of enlisting these other than human persons, enlisting them in your practical endeavors so that they're on your side, not sort of opposing you.
Wow.
So you have to gift them, right? So that they gift you back the cooperation you desire.
Yeah, but you're interacting with a vast series of processes. Almost like some people use tarot or something like that in order to get outside of
himself. I don't know a lot about tarot, but
different forces. Yeah, I don't know. I think a lot of the historic use, and more so than we think about, and then the modern use, is not really to see the future, to do divination. It's just to understand yourself and your life as a series of forces, and then get outside of your own head about that enough to get them on your side, you know, or make them conscious of, depending on your languages.
Yeah, this isn't about divining the future. This is about figuring out who are the players today. Right.
That's a really beautiful description, and I best of luck with your work. We look forward to your work on ethics and also the living art.
Living art.
You got titles? You got, you know what you're going to call them, or how far along are you through that?
Well, the skull rack is something like, it's called in Nahuatl. I guess I can't give it a Nahuatl name in a book because nobody will know what it is. Skull rack as, I can't even say milpa. I'm going to have to say as cosmic maze field, something like that. The one is conversing with time, Aztec. I've got a title. No, I don't know.
All right. Well, good luck. Yeah. I'll never look at a corn kernel the same again.
Okay. Well, good. Thanks a lot.
And if you ever, when those come out, or when you got a date on that, if you ever want to come back and promote something in a year or so, you know, please send me an email.
Okay. I'll let you know if I ever get down to Alabama. Occupy.